Hello there! Welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. My name is Justin. With me are my fellow hosts Jason and Damien, the comic book nerd. Every week we review and preview the world of comics along with other facets of geek and chic culture. Jumping right into it, Damien, how are you doing this week, sir?
I am amazing. Absolutely amazing. I just picked up a heaping book bag full of comics, reading a bunch of them, and getting ready to do a Battlestar Galactica auction this weekend.
But where's the auction going to be at?
It's going to be online, and it's going to be over by the time this thing hits the airwaves. I'll be up with PropWorks. I'm going to be selling a lot of Battlestar Galactica stuff, so it's just cool to get my hands back on flight suits and Duty Blues and
some great
Books
stuff,
of Pythia and FN Blasters. And if we were shooting video, I'd do a show and tell, but I'm sorry, next time maybe.
Get to go and brag about all your swag.
More reason for us to figure out to get the audio, to get the video working with the audio. So, all right.
Very true.
Oh yeah.
Damien, what's your first pick? What's your pick of the week?
My pick of the week. Drum roll. It was a toss-up. I wanted to talk about Kick-Ass 2 issue 3, but I said no. I want to talk about Future Foundation number 8, but no. What topped it out was Uncanny X-Men Fear Itself 542. And no, it's not because of the porn star art done by Greg Land. It is because of Colossus gets the gem of Sidorak. Woohoo! Colossus gets to kick the crap out of Juggernaut, who has been taken over by the fear god of Asgard. And Eliana takes Peter and Shadowcat to Limbo, and not only Limbo, takes them to hell and convinces Sidorak to give the gem to them to become the new avatar for destruction. And it is awesome. And it's totally making me salivate for next issue. And I know it's just a crappy offshoot. Marvel has been doing these offshoots of Fear Itself, and honestly, the offshoots are better than the main books because this is where everything happens. And if you pick up Fear Itself, you'll see Captain America running up to Sin going, "Ha ha, I'm going to stop you," and she'll point over her shoulder, and she'll go, "You see that light over there, Captain America? That is your friend's dying." And what they should do is put a little quotes that say, "In the book, go read X-Men Fear Itself 542 to see what's happening on the other side of the panel." Like, it should be that on those, like, "Why don't you go open up book 37 over in Fantastic Four and you'll read that." It's just everything, the meat and potatoes of everything that's happening in Fear Itself is taking place in other books. And
I thought they did the same thing with in Secret Invasion. Everything was going on in the side books. If you just got the main book, he didn't understand what was going on because nothing happened.
You had
happened.
No idea. Like when the Punisher and Spider-Man are down in the sewers and Punisher comes down and saves him and blows a hole through Jack-O-Lantern's head. You didn't see that in the main book. It happened in the offshoots. And it's brilliant marketing on their half and on their behalf, but it's just also frustrating as hell because ridiculously on the nose. And if you pick up, I want to say, Fear Itself 4 or 5, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about when Sin is like, "Look over there at the bright light. Something's happening in another book." You know, it's that ridiculous. Yeah. But I'm an old school X-Men fan, especially Uncanny X-Men, and the fact that I'm going to see Colossus beat the living crap out of the Juggernaut, I can't wait. So I'm really excited.
You mentioned Jack-O-Lantern going against Punisher and Spider-Man. Is that the same Jack-O-Lantern that's in the Venom run right now that he's been fiddling with?
It's same character, different person in the suit, because Jack-O-Lantern had his brains blown out in the sewer. I forgot who the two characters were, but it was a Jack-O-Lantern character and another, like, total C-lister villains that they gave the writer to kill. And it was because Spidey was getting his ass kicked. And Punisher just went, and then Captain America was like, "Frank, you're not supposed to kill people," and he kicked his ass, and Frank's all like, "I'm not going to bite you because I love you, Captain America." And then it just got really weird.
Yeah, two military men with that type of, like, romance thing going on, that just ain't right.
it was just weird. But yeah, that's pretty much my pick of the week, and I'm really, really looking forward to 543, which is coming out next month, just for the battle. Because again, like I said, I'm old school X-Men fan, especially when it seemed there was a nice theme in the X-Men world where the newbies had to go down to the pub, and then just for some reason, Juggernaut happened to be there, and then Harry's Hideaway was the bar, and they'd get into a slugfest, and they'd have to get drunk and then fight Juggernaut, and they get their asses whooped. And it was always Logan who was setting up the fight, which is even better. But I'm looking forward to this.
Because he's not going to be in it. He's going to sit there and drink a beer and just enjoy the show.
Damn right. Yeah, but Uncanny X-Men Fear Itself, 542, pick it up because it is the prelude to the ass whooping that Juggernaut's going to receive in 543.
Next month is the final run for Fear Itself, right? It's wrapped up on next month?
Yeah, I think so. And you're going to have basically Asgard is finally going to man up and come to Earth's aid. Or Earth is just going to have to save itself and go, told you, and we
Well, that was the whole thing with Iron Man, is that he's over in Asgard now, forging the weapons, doing the stuff that he needs to. But Asgard is still, by and large, saying, you know, go spin on it for a bit, because we're going to, if we're coming in, we're coming in with the Sherman method, and we're just going to fucking raise everybody.
Exactly. Yeah, Odin's plan is to just wipe out all of creation. And for those of you at home, you can't see this, but I'm showing the guys Iron Man in the Asgardian forges.
Doing his thing.
Good stuff.
Nothing like the weapons of the gods to wreak havoc across mortal Earth.
Yes.
That just means you're doing it right.
Yeah. Also, what's really cool, and I'm just going to total throw, since we're on the Fear Itself line as well, young Loki has mastered the destroyer armor, so you'll see that in the Journey to Mystery next issue.
I thought the whole thing of turning him young was to make him less of a threat, not a bigger pain in the ass.
Oh, little Loki's a pain in the ass, and he's amazingly brilliant, too. I really like this incarnation of Loki. Very cool. Very cool.
All right, Justin, what you got for us?
My pick for this week is the final issue of the current arc on American Vampire, which is wrapping up their World War II series. This one is just the big grand finale slugfest between Skinner Sweet and Pearl Jones, which you knew had been coming, had been brewing for a while. Now you finally get to see them go toe-to-toe and vamp out on each other, and it's just a fantastic freaking slugfest as the as the island is about to go down in flames because it's going to get napalmed by the American forces. So it's a terrific finale to this arc, a great wrap-up, and it leaves you with just enough of that hook at the very end that it'll make you want to buy into the next books, which I think they said they're going to Vietnam next, which that's going to be really, really cool, especially if it's going to be including some of the characters that they introduced in this story, because I could definitely see them continuing on and being part of the Vietnam War era run, and I think it'll just be phenomenal. So this was definitely the best of the week. I had a few others that I was kind of going back and forth on, but this one takes the cake, not only because of the story, but just as always, Albuquerque's art is phenomenal. It's so perfect for the type of story that it is, that nice, gritty. I don't think it's a watercolor, although it looks kind of like it, but it gives you those really kind of blurry edges, which fits well with this type of story where there is no real good, bad. There's lots of shades of gray in between. So definitely, if you're not reading the American Vampire series, go out, go buy the trades, catch up. It's a little bit difficult to get into off the beginning because of the way the beginning started with Stephen King writing like a side story along with the main beginning of the story that was going on at the same time. So it makes it a little cumbersome to get into, but once you get past that and the story starts full out, you will not want to put it down. It is so good. I will say, I think Scott Snyder, they have him set to, I'm trying to think of what book he's writing in the 52.
He's writing Detective Comics.
He's doing that. He's doing something else.
You're pulling that one out of your head. Ah, oh, nice. Pull that one out of your head.
He's doing another one too, though, because I know he's on a couple books. He's doing something that's in their dark run. Resurrection Man is the only one that he's doing. I think that is going to be the runaway hit coming out of the 52. That one's going to be the one out of left field that nobody's going to see. That's my prediction now. That's what I'm saying. So write it down in the books.
My favorite part is that they don't sparkle.
Yes. There's no piece of glitter to be found. These are bloody, vicious, tooth-clawed, rip-your-head-off, rat bastard vampires. Except for, not a sparkle thing, one of the main antagonists in this World War II story, surprisingly enough, not the Germans, not the Japanese, but the subterranean vampires that have been breeding on this island like rats. A lot of fun.
Awesome.
Now, the whole premise of American Vampire is that there are different species of vampire that have evolved on the different continents and in the different countries. So right. With that, you know, you mentioned the subterranean vampires. Did you get to see German – I'm guessing you got to see German and Japanese vampires in this story arc?
Not the Japanese. The German you do see – but not in the main American Vampire storyline. There's a separate book, Survival of the Fittest, that's going parallel to it right now. That's their kind of like side summer run. And the characters that are in there were introduced during the Old West American Vampire, and they've progressed forward along with the rest of the story. And the German vampires that you see are actually Nazis that have been given the what they call the Carpathian version of the vampires, which is the standard, you know, East European, you know, problems with sunlight, problems with garlic and silver, wood stakes, all that type of crap, you know, the standard vampire myths. So there isn't necessarily a specific German one. We have seen the Carpathian that I mentioned, the American vampire, which is a new breed, and now the subterranean species. And Schneider has said that they've got the story written out to include many of these other different types of races. I think they're going to come more from the isolated areas where the evolution really would sort of branch out and perform differently in these different areas. But he has those things written already, and he knows exactly where he wants to bring him in, what he wants to do with them. So that's going to be something really worth looking forward to in the coming months, to see what are the new ones that he does introduce, because just like Winter in the Game of Thrones, it's coming.
Yes. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of interesting new traits that vampires develop as you go through the books. Want to see some Canadian vampires, some British vampires to go against those Carpathians. Want to see what the Russian vampires would be like, you know, right out of Siberia. You know, especially, you know, the other end of that front. You know, we were fighting over the Western Front of World War II. See what the Russians were doing with their vampires over on the Eastern Front. That could be some very gory, gory stuff.
I can actually tell you right now, if you want a little bit of a humorous twist on it and you want to actually see a Siberian vampire, go read Chew.
Okay.
Chew has a Siberian vampire actually in it right now, or did, although they keep alluding back to him. So, yeah, if that's what that's what's going to get your goat, that's where you can find it.
All right.
So what was your pick for this week?
Okay, this week I went with IDW's Snake Eyes, the continuation of the Cobra Civil War story arc. It's issue number 4. Kirk Dixon with Robert Atkins on pencils, and Ninja Fight. Snake Eyes, so you know to expect, you know, ninja action from the Silent Warrior of the G.I. Joe. Now, if you were a fan of G.I. Joe back in the cartoons, this is just turning it up to 11. And you know, he goes in there, you know, has the character who's making a play to become the next Cobra Commander. In the Cobra Civil War, the Cobra Commander has been killed, and there are several different people, including Major Blood, the Baroness, and Tomax of the Twins, Tomax and Zaymot, as well, that are all fighting for the rulership of Cobra. Serpentor is around, but he's not technically in the running, although we'll see how that works out. He's kind of playing the politics to set himself up to become the next commander behind the scenes. But basically, the board of directors of Cobra has said, if you want to be the next Cobra commander, we want to see a body count of G.I. Joes. And Snake Eyes is, of course, one of the number one targets, being as much trouble as he's caused for Cobra over the years. So you get to see this. You know, if you remember the character Slice and Dice that were, you know, later came out, it's Cobra, it's Snake Eyes versus them. You got Iceberg and Alpine. So you got a number of different characters. You've got a Chuck Dixon original character Helix in here. And, of course, you know, you've got the relationship between Snake Eyes and Scarlet. This is the actual end of the arc. You know, it was the first four-issue arc for the Snake Eyes run. And so it ends this arc, and it kind of catches you up to speed with what's been going on in the other comics, the G.I. Joe Cobra ongoing and the G.I. Joe ongoing. So, you know, it kind of catches you up there and then spins off into the next arc, as well as leaving some untied ends, some loose ends from this story arc that you know are going to come back to haunt Snake Eyes later in the run. And, yeah, Chuck and Robert did an amazing job with this book. It was a lot of fun to read. And, yeah, I wish I had more. I wish it was a bigger book.
You mentioned Serpentor and that he's not in the running for the next commander. Refresh me on this, because in this version of the story, Serpentor isn't the, you know, weird snake-headed, goofy-ass thing that he was in the cartoon. He's more of like a cultist, like a charismatic cult leader kind of thing.
Yeah, it's much more of a religious, spiritual leader for Cobra. He does have the snake hood, you know, the head, the snake hood head that kind of goes over. You know, so he's kind of wearing a snake head as a hood, if you're from the character. But it's not near, and he doesn't usually wear it. It's more of a ceremonial thing. So, you know, you still get, if you like the action figure, you like the original portrayal of him in the comics, you still get that. But he's much more charismatic in the new comic book. And he is kind of the spiritual leader behind Cobra. And the interesting thing is they took some of the elements that really upset people about the G.I. Joe cartoon movie with Cobra Law and Globulus and turned them into religious elements that you can see a cult following. Whereas, you know, in the movie it was just kind of like, oh yeah, by the way, you know, you had G.I. Joe fighting Cobra in a fairly real world setting, you know, lasers and advanced weaponry, but otherwise it was fairly normal in the comics. And or if you read the original Marvel run by Larry Hama, who's now continuing his run with IDW in G.I. Joe, a Real American Hero. Yeah. He had his own civil war with Cobra Commander and Serpentor. But, you know, the spin that they've taken to have, you know, the, you know, oddball elements that came out of the cartoon with Globulus and Cobra Law and creating, you know, that they're more of a utopian ideal and the Globulus is more of a god character. It really actually works, you know, for a cult and a group that's trying to take over the world. So it really makes it an interesting. It makes Serpentor a much more interesting character than saying he was cloned from all the great leaders.
Well, it makes him a more dangerous character too, because he's more realistic, he's more rooted, and it gives the reader a little bit more to kind of sink their teeth into, something they can identify with, as far as, you know, here's this type of person that we've seen historically and we can identify as, you know, okay, this is a bad guy and here's why, as opposed to this sort of, you know, like you said, you know, the goofy nebulous, you know, he is this super villain by this mash of, you know, crap from through history, instead of actually creating him as a character.
Yeah, I think he's much more dangerous in this incarnation of G.I. Joe than even as he was in the Larry Hama comics, which, you know, Larry had to deal a whole lot with, oh, we've got a new character coming out, work him into the comic book so we can sell the action figure. Yeah, so he'd have characters that would show up for a couple of issues and then disappear. You know, actually, you know, Serpentor being the new Cobra leader that they were doing with the toys had to last a lot longer, and he wrote an amazing story arc with the Cobra Civil War on Cobra Island for that. You know, go back and read that and check up on that in the Marvel run of G.I. Joe, Real American Hero. Him has just done an amazing job all the way through. So.
Good. And aside from this, you were also... You had picked up the trade, or you had picked up my trades, actually, to be specific, of Incorruptible and Irredeemable. What did you think of those?
I've been having a lot of fun reading those, especially when I found the point where they matched up, and you're seeing events happen in Irredeemable, and then following through with Incorruptible. The basic premise of Irredeemable is you've got this Superman-esque character, the most powerful being on Earth, who has gone around being the typical Boy Scout that we normally associate with Superman right now, trying to help everybody, trying to do the right thing all the time, never lies, doesn't kill, and he snapped. He's just lost it completely, and we see what happens when the most powerful being on Earth goes from being a hero to being a villain. And all the heroes that he's been fighting alongside, you get the JLA, the JSA type teams, and they have nothing that they can do. They're called the Paradigm, and they have nothing that they can do to stop him from destroying entire cities as he pleases. And so you get to follow along with these heroes as they try and figure out a way to stop the Plutonian, the Superman character, from destroying the world. And the flip side of that is Incorruptible, where you take Max Damage, who's been a villain, and was one of the people that would stand toe-to-toe with the Plutonian.
He's the only villain that ever stood toe-to-toe with Plutonian, if I remember correctly. Like, he's the only one that actually did a stand-up slugfest with Plutonian to a draw.
But he always knew that he was going to lose because he knew that Plutonian was that much powerful to him, and he always had the faith of the Plutonian that the Plutonian would stop when he was done for. It's like watching a boxing match where one guy is completely outclassed by the other. And if you've ever seen a match where the guy who's the better boxer is just sitting there punching the other guy at will and turns and looks at the ref and goes, "Are you going to stop this? No? Okay, I'll hit the guy again. How about now? All right, one more time. Are you going to stop it now?" Those were always the type of fight that Max Damage would have with the Plutonian. He always knew the Plutonian would stop. And all of a sudden, when the Plutonian flipped, he's lost his faith because he doesn't know what he can depend on anymore. The most trustworthy thing in the world is gone. And so he goes out to become that hero, to be the guy that he always was fighting against.
Yeah, it's interesting, kind of a parallel to that too, is that not even so much that he knew the Plutonian would stop before he killed him if they went, got into a fight, but the stuff that Max did, like he would go out and just do this horrific, horrible things because he knew there was somebody out there who could stop him, and that there wasn't a way for him to, kind of go beyond what he should or could, because the Plutonian would always keep him from doing the worst thing possible. And with Plutonian then going villain, he doesn't have that limitation anymore, and instead of rejoicing in that and going and being the worst he could be, he instead realizes, well, if he's not going to stop me, I have to stop myself, and in doing so also set the limit for the other villains that are beneath me to give them that ceiling, give them that, this is the line that you can't cross because I said so, and there's no authority higher than me that's going to keep you from doing that.
It's really interesting because you see just how bad he was, and his initial sidekick is called Jailbait, and it's a 16-year-old girl that he's been sleeping with, and all of a sudden he has to stop. And he's trying to figure out how to be good, and the only way that he knows to be good is to say, what would I do? Now do the opposite. And so his initial journey is trying to figure out, what can I do to do good? How do I do the opposite of what I initially want to do? So, he decides he needs to stop sleeping with Jailbait. And then he's got to try and find his way, to befriending
or find somebody that can guide him, which he tries to find in the one cop that he couldn't corrupt, but it turns out has his own skeletons in the closet, being a recovering alcoholic, and he's got his own moral dilemmas and issues that he's trying to work with, and so he gets drafted by Max to sort of be his moral compass, and the guy doesn't feel like he has a moral compass of his own. He's trying to figure it out as much as anybody else is, which I think is more of what he kind of ends up teaching Max, is you got to find your own moral compass. You can't, rely on somebody else to tell you what's right. You have to do what's right, which does fall into that whole idea of, okay, well, this is what I would have done, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do the exact opposite. But before we get into too far into the story of both Irredeemable and Incorruptible, because I know we could spend an entire night talking about just those two books alone, let me change gears, and I'm going to jump over to a book that came out this week, but I am really looking forward to the rest of the series. It was the number one of The Legend of Drizzt, which is the latest Dungeons & Dragons book from IDW. IDW has done two runs already for Dungeons & Dragons. They've done the main D&D line, and they also did one for Dark Sun when the Dark Sun line was launched by Wizards of the Coast. In this one, it's actually written by R.A. Salvatore and his son Gino, who have been teaming up together on the Drizzt books coming out in the new 4th edition D&D world, the latest of which, I believe, is Gauntlet Grimm. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty good book. It's, if you've followed the Drizzt series at all, either through the Icewind Dale trilogy, through the Legacy of the Drow, or very much, way back in the beginning during his kind of prelude days, you know the character, you're familiar with the character, you know the writing. If you don't know the character, number one, get the rock off of you. Number two, go find this stuff. This is like the fantasy books that are the core of what defines fantasy books. The Forgotten Realms is not necessarily the core D&D world, but I think it's probably the most used, the most well-known, the most well-defined world in the world of Dungeons & Dragons. And this character in that world is one of the most well-known, the most popular, the most written about characters, and has been aped and mimed and parodied numerous times over because of it. However, regardless of that, there's a reason he's the most popular. He's a very compelling character. He's a very interesting character. He is the dark, and he is the anti-hero in the sense of he has this sort of dark side to him, this dark heritage, but is very much a noble soul, somebody that's out trying to do the right thing. And that has been his character up until now. All of the characters that have shared his story, he's outlived them. So all of his friends are dead. All of his friends have gone on to do their own thing, and he has now found himself alone, which he is oddly actually enjoying. He feels this freedom from responsibility because he doesn't have anybody that he needs to think about or be worried about, and he can go out and follow his wanderlust and do what he wants to do. Gauntlet Grimm is the book that is the transition from his previous life to this new life, and the comic is the follow-up to Gauntlet Grimm. This is actually going to be the bridge in between that book and the next one that's coming out, I think sometime next year, called Neverwinter. And it's going to outline the story between the two. If you've read the Gauntlet Grimm book, you have to pick this up. It is an excellent, excellent supplement to that story. If you haven't read Gauntlet Grimm, that's okay. You can still pick it up anyways. It's still an enjoyable book. It's got good art. It's got a good story. You are probably going to be a little bit confused on the characters. You're not really going to understand what's going on if you're not familiar with them to begin with. But I still think you'd probably enjoy it anyways, because there's enough to it in the way of action, in the way of story, that'll begin to set the hook, and you'll want to know more about these characters, and you'll want to go find out more. So this is one that I'm really, really looking forward to. I'm going to be checking my box month after month to make sure as soon as this comes out that I can grab it and read it as quick as I can, because it is – I think it's going to be just unbelievable. And I have a nagging feeling at the back of my head that as this comes to a conclusion and it gets closer to the release of Neverwinter, I'm going to start hounding Barnes & Noble and getting a pre-order for that book as soon as it comes out so I can just continue with the story right after that. But – that being said, one of the other big things that's coming out, and it's coming out this coming week, there's been lots of news about it, there's been lots of talk about it, and I dare say we would be doing a disservice if we didn't talk about it, and that's JLA number one with Geoff Johns and Jim Lee, the big, big names. Polio, do you have any personal opinions that you want to throw in about the relaunch of the mother of all flagship books?
I think it's going to be a real good book. Some of the preview pages that they've been giving out, it's going to be a lot of fun. They're going to set the tone for the new DC Universe. That's one of the reasons why I'm actually looking forward to this, is to see what the tone of the new DC Universe is going to be. They're telling us they're resetting a lot of stuff, that you know, Superman's not going to be the Boy Scout character that he was, that he's going to still be finding himself, that you know, Bruce is going to be brooding. One of the first things they show us is Bruce and Green Lantern. Batman versus Green Lantern, the dark side versus the light side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're showing the true fun that you can have with Green Lantern is, you know, he brings out a fire truck and just runs somebody over with it created from his ring. So, you know, there's fun. You know, Geoff Johns has pointed out he's trying to add humor to the stories. They're not going to be funny stories, but there's going to be humor within them. So, and Geoff has been on a tear. You know, he's done an amazing job reinventing characters over the past couple of years, bringing new life to, you know, characters that people had forgotten about or that had been literally dead in the DC universe. And he's also taken characters that were nobodies and has-beens and never wases and turned those into compelling characters that actually make viable villains or even or heroes. So it'll be interesting to see where he takes this. You know, and of course, you know, Jim Lee is co-publisher of DC Comics, so yeah, he's also known for his run on the X-Men. That's where he made his bones. You know, he did the Batman Hush storyline, which had great acclaim. Yeah, he's one of my favorites.
Well, not to mention he had his entire own publishing company in Wildstorm, where he had the Wildcats, where he had Gen 13, where he had Welcome to Tranquility. Gail Simone, that's for you.
Yeah. Yeah. To be fair, he didn't do the art on all of those books, and he you know, didn't write – But yeah,
well, except for Tranquility. Tranquility, he didn't do the art on. That was somebody else. But it was a Wildstorm comic, so.
Yeah, but that was his company. Of course, by the time you know, Welcome to Tranquility came out, you know, they were bought by DC. But you know, it showed that he knew what he knows what he's doing, coming in there to be co-publisher of DC Comics with Dan DiDio. And you know, it's you know, seeing him and Geoff Johns working on a title, it's for some people the creative dream team, and you know, Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson playing basketball. You know. So it's one of those team ups that.
What, no Larry Bird?
About. Larry Bird, too.
Love for the white boy. Come on. Don't leave him out.
I got it. So, yeah. But the biggest thing is this is going to set the tone for the upcoming DC titles. Now.
It, correct me if I'm wrong. It really does seem to me that the overall tone of the DCU is taking a turn to the dark, which if you – I thought about this not too long ago. I was talking comics with some of the guys from work. And in the 90s, there was this whole sort of brooding hero complex thing that happened where every single hero had to become this like – almost a crow clone. You know, they had to become dark. They had to become emotional. They had to have issues. You know, they couldn't be these shining, noble heroes of the past because that just wasn't the flavor of the time. In 2000, we've seen with the resurgence of a lot of the characters that Geoff Johns has done, they've come back as heroes. I mean, as very definitively heroes. But they still have complexities. And so it seems like the way they're trying to move the universe, and this is cyclic too. I think this has happened during the crises. This has happened in Marvel, in DC, probably in Image as well, although I can't necessarily name any specific titles because I don't know them well enough. But everybody keeps wanting comic characters and the comic stories to mature. They want them to get older. They want them to get more complex. But it seems like certain writers, or maybe the publishers in general, feel that the only way they can make the stories more complex is by making them moody, just to make them dark. Like, they have to put in violence, they have to put in the, curse, or they have to, do whatever is like the stereotypical schlocky kind of, oh, look at how edgy we are, we put in blood, or we put in sex, or whatever it is. And they miss the target of, we're trying to make it mature. Like, we're trying to grow them up, which is, I think, what the DC reboot has been trying to do, but is in many ways missing the mark with many books. I mean, as it is, they flat out are saying they have an entire line of comics that they're calling The Dark, which I can understand. Okay, those are going to be the little bit darker titles, the ones that are more horror-based, the ones that are, maybe will be a little bit edgier, but they can be edgy without being dark.
I think dark is, for the dark itself, that's probably a good way of putting it, but I think that's one of the things why they're trying to reboot, is they felt the DC had gotten too complicated, that, people missed the Superman, Lois, Clark Kent love triangle. They wanted to bring that back in, and the humor that you can get from that. As I said, Geoff Johns is looking for ways that he can infuse humor into the stories he's writing. So they're not trying to make them dark. A lot of that darkness came actually from the 80s with Return of the Dark Knight and the
Frank Miller.
Which was Frank Miller and the the Watchmen from Alan Moore. When you go back and you look at those were all about dark. And up until then, superheroes had all been bright, shiny, happy. And that was really what caused the change in characters.
Garth Ennis.
Yeah. But I think what you're going to see is DC is really trying to stretch their brand. They're trying to cover all of the different bases. So you're going to have, your horror books, which are the dark titles, with Frankenstein mm-hmm. and the magic, the dark JLA. Who deal with
demon.
The demon. And you're going to have, they've got their Western title with, All-Star Westerns.
Oh, Jonah.
Yeah. Well, Jonah Hex is probably going to be the main star of that, but they're going back to the All-Star Western, which is the original title Jonah appeared in. And that allows them a bit more flexibility than just following Jonah Hex. So you're going to have a Western if you want to read a Western. You're going to have Sergeant Rock coming back. They're doing a new Sergeant Rock series. So if you like your military, you're going to have Sergeant Rock operating. Of course, they're going to have their typical Bat family, which will probably – you've got Batman, Dark Side.
Think of it.
Bruce, or you're going to have Dick Grayson, the former Robin, as Nightwing, and he's going to be a more brighter character.
One thing I did want to mention, though, you mentioned Sergeant Rock. I do remember hearing that Sergeant Rock is not easy company. It's not – it is Easy Company, but it's not the original Sergeant Rock. It's actually going to be his grandson, I think. And it is actually modern set. It'll be Afghanistan, Iraq, Middle East. I wonder if they put the Arab Spring in there, but it's like the Irish Spring, but stinkier. Where it's supposed to be like, he is this descendant from this very well-known war hero, and him kind of coming to grips with that and making his own place and his own stake and claim in the in the armed forces that he's serving in, and making himself known as opposed to being known as, oh, you're the kid or the grandson of this great guy. So
I don't know that they're actually going for the history lesson there, because from my understanding, he's from Rock is from Brooklyn. as the All-American kid. And just like there are kids that's dads and their grandfathers were firefighters, and there are kids that's dads and father fighter were cops, his dad and his grandfather and his great-grandfather, they were all soldiers. So that's what he is. It's what runs in his family. And so he's leading a team of special ops. And I think the first story, I guess they said, takes place in Africa. So you know, we'll have to see. But, you know, DC is trying to stretch, you know, from just capes and cowls, even though they're keeping it within the DC universe. You're going to have demons and ghouls and magic in one corner. You're going to have your military with Sergeant Rock. You're going to have Westerns with All-Star Western. They're trying to expand their, you know, milieu, so you're not just stuck in a capes and cowls genre. You have other story arcs. You have other, you know, types of characters that you can read, and you can still find them all in the DC universe. And, you know, while you're reading Sergeant Rock, it will take place in the DCU, so you'll hear stories of things going on around Sergeant Rock that relate to other characters. You know, like if they're in Africa, you might hear about Batwing, which is the Batman Inc. character that operates in Africa.
But I think that's a very important point to make, too, because these books existed already in Vertigo. And Vertigo is DC, so it's not like they were losing any money there. But the fact that they can have that crossover now because they're pulling them into the DCU proper as opposed to leaving them out, because that's what Vertigo is for. Vertigo is for the books that don't fall well into the DC idea of what comic books should be.
Sergeant Rock has always been a DC property, as has, you know, Jonah Hex with All-Star Western. Those have always been published by DC. John Constantine was originally DC property. They moved him over to Vertigo. They've had an amazing run with Vertigo.
I don't know if that's true.
That is, as is Swamp Thing. Yeah, they moved them out of DC proper and into Vertigo so they could tell more adult stories with those characters. And actually, those stories are going to stay. They're going to exist. And the Vertigo runs of those characters may continue. I believe Constantine is still continuing.
But Hellblazer definitely is. I do know that.
Yeah. You're going to have a secondary version of these characters, which is going to be more all-ages version of these characters. It's not going to be quite as harsh, not quite as adult in the DC universe. One of these things DC has become acutely aware of, and they say that they're trying to do, and we'll have to see how it goes, is create titles that are more available to all ages. Now, with Scott Snyder, his run on DC Comics, you're definitely not going to hand that to a young teenager. But, you know, there are certainly, you know, I've been reading, you know, was reading Kid Flash and go, this is great for kids. They just finished their run with Supergirl that, you know, you could give to a younger child. And I think they're becoming aware that they have to get younger children reading their books. They have to have a younger audience. Because
you got to get the infusion of new blood.
Be reading their books in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, and that's one of the things, too. The only thing that I worry about, and I am not sure this will happen, but the fear I have, especially with a character like Constantine, Constantine, who has had such a long run in the Vertigo universe and has a very established character, very established personality and interaction, is that they're people who are fans of him are going to want to see, okay, let's see what he does in the DCU. And they're going to get turned off because they're going to find it to be a watered-down, washy version of the character that they're just not going to like because it doesn't have that punch that it has from the Vertigo.
Well, you're a fan of, you know, Hellblazer and his work from the Vertigo publications, and you just read the, you know, aftermath of Brightest Day, which featured Constantine searching for Swamp Thing. How did you feel that character matched up? Was that a watered-down version of Constantine?
It is a little bit. They did well with this so far. There were parts of it that I think very well just could have straight up been the writer and his particular little twist on it. Constantine's been written by a lot of different authors, and they all do take a slightly different kind of beat on him. You can always tell when the British writers get a hold of him because he doesn't have the, you know, completely ridiculous amount of Cockney slang in his speech that the American authors tend to do with him. Anyways, he was still himself. He was still the character. for lack of a better way to put it, though, instead of saying watered down, maybe a better way to put it would say eroded. He was almost like boiled away. Like a lot of the flavor had been removed from the character through because you aren't getting the little I'm trying to think of the right word for it, intricacies that you would have within the character. So it made him bland. You know, not watered down, I suppose, is an okay way to say it. It did water him down a little bit, but he still had the punch. He was still the same guy. It was still the same core of the character, but without as much spice, without as much flavor. That's kind of the best way that I can think of to explain it. So that actually was the Brightest Day Aftermath that gave me this fear in the first place. That made me think of it, because I do think that with his run with the JLA Dark, it'll be wonderful to see him interact with the other DCU characters, because he will be a constant thorn in their side, and that will be just phenomenally entertaining to watch. But I still think I would spend more of my time on the Vertigo books, because that's where the better version of him is going to be. That's my personal call. That's what I think.
Well, that's perfectly legitimate, you know, to say that you prefer the Vertigo version. And I think you're right. We may see that happen, is that you're not going to have people liking the character that have been reading the Vertigo books. However, the other half of that is, you know, with the, you know, them trying to get younger kids in, you know, by using the Dark title, you know, they have the Dark JLA, with Constantine intermixing with them, intermingling with other characters, it's going to introduce people that haven't read any Constantine, and particularly those of a younger age, to him. So, you know, I think, you know, it's kind of a smart move to bring him back in. And again, they're keeping the two story arcs separate. You know, when John Constantine left the DC Universe, whatever had happened to him is going to pick up from there. They're not having what happened in the Vertigo Universe have occurred in the DC. It just happens to be the same character. It's kind of what Marvel has done with their Ultimate line. You know, those are their own continuity of titles.
Yeah. So that's easy enough for them to do, too, because the Vertigo line spends most of its time in England. I mean, it's over in the UK. He's doing his thing over there. And the majority of the DCU stuff is occurring stateside. So they can keep those lines separate pretty easily. And they could still say that whether they want to cross over or not, you know, it's up to them to decide if they want to mix it at their leisure. So that's really a smart move on their part, in the sense that they have that freedom and flexibility without causing too much of a jumble and continuity issue. So anyways, I think we've chewed our listeners' ears off for JLA for now, and 50 Reboot. And in all honesty, we're going to be, you know, going back and forth over this stuff until it finally hits next week, and even all next month. I mean, we're going to be doing nothing probably but talking 52, so I suppose we should just sort of come to accept that.
Yeah, it's going to be the big discussion point for the whole month as they relaunch all the titles throughout the month. So we'll deal with them as they come up, but, you know, it is kind of a big thing to note that JLA number one is coming out. So we'll see how that goes, and we'll have to, you know, play each title as it comes out. Of course, Flashpoint number 5 is going to lead directly into that. So,
that's next week along with JLA. So, and speaking of Flashpoint, one of the tie-ins I know you said you were really enjoying was the Kid Flash tie-in to Flashpoint. That one is actually up for our best panel of the week, isn't it?
Yeah, and looking at it, and back down on page 10. In issue 2 of 3, which is actually from a couple weeks ago. I finally got around to reading it. Had it. On page 10, the bottom part of the panel is kind of this Back to the Future effect as Bart realizes that he's starting to lose himself because he's in an alternate timeline. And so it's just a wonderful, whereas in Back to the Future, they just had the picture, and you start to see Marty's brother disappear and his sister disappear. Yeah, and at the end of the movie, his hand starts to fade in and out as he's playing the guitar. And they do a wonderful version, which is much more creepy looking, by having the skin start turning translucent, the muscle and tissues coming off of the bones and disappearing. And part of his face, you see the teeth, because there's no flesh over the lips and no muscles there. So it's a wonderful, wonderful panel. And I also think we need to give an honorable mention to Batman Incorporated with the art by Scott Clark and Dave Beatty. Batman Incorporated number 8 is a wonderfully Tron-esque art. It's a very high contrast, minimal colors, which makes it very moody. It did at points become a little difficult to follow the action, but I think you need to pick up the issue because I haven't seen this art in a comic book, so I think it was really worth, you know, going out there and picking up the comic and taking a look through it. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. You're not going to see very many comics come out with this type of a style. It's a very story-specific style. But it just blew me away. I opened it up and went, wow, this is pretty cool. And, you know, even if I didn't want to read the story, I was like, I got to read it just for the art in here. So, yeah, it was a good cool. week.
For that one's not necessarily a best panel. That's sort of a best book as far as art for the week.
It was just kind of an honorable mention. I think the Flashpoint Kid Flash Lost issue 2 of 3 had the best panel. That just kind of blew my mind to see it because it was just so well done. But with the DC, again, it's something that it's going to be story specific. You're not going to see a lot of art done that way. So it was kind of worth it to pick it up. It was kind of a one-time thing. And being that it was the end of this run of Batman Incorporated, it was, you know, a great ending, you know, because the story was good and the art just amazing. So, but we got more comics next week, don't we?
This is true. And actually, before we go, there is one more thing I want to mention. Not necessarily a best panel of the week, but I will say it was my favorite panel of the week. We talked about this a little bit before the show. It was in the Green Lantern Emerald Warriors from this week. This was the Guy Gardner Batman crossover.
That was a great story too.
Yeah, it Emerald Warriors has been doing one-and-dones, knowing that it's wrapping up. It's coming to the end of its run with the reboot. So I think they're just having kind of more fun with the stories and with the stuff that they can play with. But the best panel right at the end of this one actually has a throwback to Green Lantern Rebirth from Geoff Johns, even though this is written by Peter Tomasi. It's a comedy callback that is just – delicious. It's straight up Guy. It's straight up Batman, and it had me laughing out loud. So if you've read Green Lantern Rebirth or you're planning on reading Green Lantern Rebirth, go ahead and read it and then pick up this issue. And right near the end, you'll be able to find it. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't want to spoil anything. So by all means, go pick it up. You'll enjoy it. It's hilarious.
The issue was great on its own. I love the one-and-dones they've been doing. They don't do enough of those in comics these days. So to see a one-and-done, especially a well-done one-and-done, it was a lot of fun. And so I enjoyed the book. I wish they would do some more one-and-dones like that. And that ending was just a great ending to a good book. So,
oh, yeah. And definitely.
Speaking of good endings.
No doubt. Yeah, we'll go ahead and wrap up the show here. As always, thank you for listening. You can contact us by going to the website, thecomicbooknerd.com. I know our good friend Damien has actually, I believe, a link in the sidebar now to these netcasts. So you can find this one and all the others, archives if we can get them, and all the ones going forward from there. Once we get our technical issues fixed, you can find us streaming at Ustream. The channel is The Comic Book Tesseract. You can find all of us on Twitter. Damien is at A Comic Book Nerd. I am at Felix T. Cat. That's with a K and 2 T's. And Jason is at J. Polyev. And that, I believe, is that. Have a good week, everybody. And we will see you next week. Take care.